Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is James Freeman, who is a former musician and the founder of the Bluebell Coffee, one of the top coffee roasters, along with Intelligentsia, Stumptown Coffee, Counterculture Coffee, and so on. And now James have multiple coffee shops in Bay Area, LA, New York, and even in Tokyo. And you may know coffee culture in Japan is quite serious, unique, and profound. So today we'll talk about James' experience with Japanese coffee culture and the difference between American and Japanese coffee cultures, how James applies elements of Japanese coffee culture to blue bottle coffee, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as iTunes and Stitcher as a podcast. Please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats. Also, if you have any ideas about the show, topics of the show and the show guests, please let me know. You can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. And in fact, today's topic, Japanese coffee, was suggested by one of our listeners. So thank you so much. So now let's start a conversation with James Freeman. Hello, James. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. So I heard you used to be a professional musician. So what was your relationship with coffee before you started Blue Bottle Coffee?
Well, I have a complicated history with coffee as a musician. Sometimes you need coffee to function. As a human, I suppose you need coffee to function sometimes. But my relationship with coffee was similar, in parallel with my relationship with music, because it was being driven by this perfection complex, only coffee seemed more controllable. Long ago in the 90s was when I was working as a musician, and I started to discover roasting coffee at home. And I was also interested in food. I was a farmer's market shopper in San Francisco. There's a beautiful food community and beautiful producers in San Francisco. I would roast green coffee, unroasted coffee, at home on a perforated baking sheet in my oven. And how coffee changed over time, how it was different on day two, day three, day four, day five, was very fascinating with me. And it was more than fascinating. It was compelling because at that time in San Francisco, there was literally nowhere you could go where you knew when the coffee was roasted. That seemed wrong. This idea of coffee as fresh food was undiscovered. It seemed undiscovered. And that was, you know, it was in the 90s before the internet had taken the joy systematically out of these personal discoveries. So I felt like I owned this, that this was this revelatory idea that nobody was talking about, nobody was thinking about at that time. And so my simultaneous disenchantment with being a musician, never being perfect enough, was coupled with my interest in coffee and knowing that I could make some like very interesting taste, very compelling taste that I wasn't experiencing out in the world at that time. And, you know, ignorance is bliss. I thought I could do it. I understood the model of commerce. I didn't have a business background. I still don't have a business background except at Blue Bottle. And this
model is huge.
Yeah. This model of commerce, you know, you make something, you bring it to a market on Saturday, somebody gives you money for it, you give them that thing, and then you repeat, right? How hard could it be?
Right. Well, it's amazing that, you know, I heard that you started your own roasting and very small amount, and then you started to bring your coffee and a drip at the market. So it's the smell, powerful smell. Get people.
Yeah, it wasn't common to have coffee made one cup at a time. At that time, I started Blue Bottle in 2002. Still not particularly common now, but it's more common, I suppose. But this idea of waiting for a coffee that's made just for you, that making a single cup of coffee is a craft, and it's worth waiting for, it's worth studying how to do it better, that was very much not in the public mind, the food public's mind at that time. Now it's generally understood as being more accepted, more acceptable. But at that time, there were the lines would back up at the farmer's market, and some people were thrilled, some people were angry. You know how that goes.
Right, it's amazing. In 15 years, a lot changed. And, you know, like
15 years.
You're leading what's called the third wave coffee, which is completely different level of approaching beans and freshness, like you said. So.
Well, is it? I sometimes take offense, not offense. I think I question that terminology, third wave coffee. I wonder how helpful it is. It's very much self-congratulatory. But, you know, just think about Baja coffee in Minami-senju, out in the eastern part of Tokyo, right? Tanaka-san has been sourcing single origin coffees, roasting them really well, a variety of roasts, making them one cup at a time since 1968, right? You know, what wave was that?
Right.
You know, I think that that term, third wave coffee, is helpful, but only to a point.
Interesting. It's an American continental term.
Yeah.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. So how do you define a great cup of coffee?
How do I? How should I? How did I?
Whichever you like.
Well, you know, and a long time ago, if I wanted it a certain way, I had to make it myself. And now when I want it a certain way, I can go to our shops. And there's a lot of shops that have opened in the last 15 years that I feel like are executing coffee very well. And then, as I referred to, there are a lot of shops that have been open for 40 years that are making coffee really, really in a delicious way. So yeah, I look for inspiration. I look for this moment of appreciation and trying to be around somebody who's inspired when they're making it, or a product that's inspiring. I think that moment of inspiration is why people go to cafes.
Okay. So coffee being inspiring. How do you make your coffee inspiring to your customers?
It starts by admitting that the performance around the particular taste of coffee is important too and influential too. What people see when they walk in, what the door handle feels like, what the space is like. Is it inviting? Do they get a greeting? You know, is there a pleasant place to, or pleasant person to talk to ask any questions? The fact, sometimes coffee is intimidating to people. So is it an environment where if somebody has a question, they feel like they can get it answered in a friendly and helpful way? You know, all of those conditions surround this cup of coffee. So those conditions have to be met. And then the absolute, you know, impeccability of the coffee has to be met too. Is it, you know, well sourced, well roasted, well prepared? Is it served in an appealing way? All of those little micro conditions have to be embedded in this thing that we call going out for coffee in order for it to be a meaningful and inspiring experience.
Right. And coffee, actually, they are, beans are alive.
Yeah.
And there's so many elements like water, its temperature.
Yeah.
Right. Sounds like
particle size, extraction, all of that. What kind of cup it's in influences how people feel about it.
Right. And also human elements of baristas. And
human elements. There are human elements.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
It sounds like it's as difficult as playing a clarinet.
No, it's not.
Really?
No, it's not. As we were talking about earlier, you know, being the clarinet, being in classical music, the standards of perfection are so high. And if you don't execute it well, then you've disappointed Johann Sebastian Bach. You know, you've failed Mozart if you don't do it right. Mm. You know, that's a horrible feeling. You feel like you failed Mozart. Mm. You know, so coffee, you can do it over. If you don't make it right, you can tell the guest, oh, can I do this again? You know, this espresso didn't come out exactly. Mm. And usually the guest is delighted. They say, of course, I'm so glad you care so deeply. And then you get another chance. There's no second chances when you play Mozart.
Right. So that's why you're really into coffee.
It feels so much easier. Yeah.
Okay. So I heard that you've been to Japan quite a few times.
Yes. And
so
one day I'll go and never come back.
I could see even. Yeah. So when and where and what kind of, what was your first encounter with Japanese coffee culture?
First encounter with Japanese coffee culture was in 2008. I had just opened our shop in Mint Plaza in San Francisco that this, I guess you could call him a Japanese coffee mentor that I've known since 2004. He works for UCC Coffee Company. His name's Jay Igami, but he's based in San Francisco. And he was the one, when I was making pour-over coffee, rather clumsily with just pouring the water in a steaming pitcher, he was the one who told me this history of the delicate swan-necked kettles and measuring the time, measuring the brewing ratio. Mm. And I had this moment of thinking, that sounds so hard. Mm. And then I was like, oh, but I want to try it.
Right.
And then so he actually imported the first pouring kettles into the United States for us. Mm. And I finally went in 2008. And Jay took me and my wife, Caitlin, to, must have been 8 or 9 different kisaten on like the second day in Tokyo.
Right. Well, kisaten, by the way, we're going to just dig into that term.
Yes.
Basically Japanese old style coffee shop.
Yeah, old school. what were the three words that you used at the beginning of the show? Profound, unique.
Serious, profound, and unique.
Yeah, serious, profound, and unique. I think that's a very nice way of describing a good kisaten. But anyway, Jay took me to these kisaten, and you know, sometimes the coffee I thought was delicious. It wasn't always to my taste. It was always made in a very particular way. It always had a point of view behind it. There was like a master, and it's usually he, and he was in charge of defining the space, its characteristics, and the taste of the coffee.
Mm.
So it was a real moment of me questioning my own choices and my own career, because when our shop on Mint Plaza opened, you know, I was on the front page of the food section of the New York Times, and like we got tons of press, and I thought I was pretty good at coffee. And then here I go to Tokyo and see these people with far more mastery than I had at that point. And I really had to question sort of how hard I was working, what I was working on, what I needed to do to be better. It was a kind of a terrifying moment, but exhilarating moment that day.
Mm, wow. Okay, so let's talk about kisaten then. So kisaten is the foundation of Japanese coffee culture, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
So could you tell us what it is? Like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you what it is for me. I've been thinking about this interview, and what I don't want it to be is like, for those of you who are listening to this, I'm just another American guy, and I don't want to be the expert on something. You know, I'm not a Japanese person, and I have a tremendous appreciation for many parts of Japanese culture, but I'm not an expert of that. So I don't want to be like one of these like young American chefs who all of a sudden like go to Japan, all of a sudden they're experts on ramen, right? You know? So I don't want to be that guy who's somehow an expert in Japanese culture, because I'm not. But I can evaluate the kisaten experience as a performance, as an art, and take it on those terms. I've read about Japanese coffee culture and thought about it very deeply and have a tremendous appreciation. But my vantage point is from considering this beautiful performance, this beautiful art piece that I'm lucky enough to be invited to when I go to Tokyo. And from that, it's about a rigorous application of these thoughts about hospitality and execution And when I go to a good kisaten, I see a sense of purpose, but also a sense of modesty. Like any of the virtuoso stuff is so deeply embedded, you have to kind of be a little bit of an expert in order to notice it. So the performance of the kisaten, the rigorous control over brew volumes and extraction and just pouring, you know, you think, like, how can it be beautiful to watch somebody pour water out of a kettle? But it really, like, I think virtuosity can exist in many forms.
Right.
And that's so that some of the best kisaten I see, such virtuosity. I call it the pearl necklace in pouring so slowly, but so methodically and so controlled. You see these little connected, bead of droplets of water, and they make this little sound, this little tearing sound that goes around and around the coffee, sometimes 5 or 6 minutes, uninterrupted, getting exactly what the master wants out of coffee, nothing that he doesn't want. And so just to be around that, it's usually if there's music on the stereo, it's classical music, it would be kind of, I guess, described as an uptight environment. You're not going to talk raucously to your friends. There's no Wi-Fi. You're going to sit quietly. And if you have a conversation, it's going to be in this tone of voice that you and I are using. So it's not an upbeat place necessarily, but it's a place for like contemplation of two things that I truly love, and that's coffee and cake.
Right. Yeah, it's like a meditating kind of.
Yeah.
I really think many other people can describe, including Japanese people like you did. So.
Well, that's nice. Nice of you to say.
Right. And the history of kisaten is quite long. So the first kisaten opened in Ueno, Tokyo, in 1888 by a foreign ministry official. And then in 1911, a group of painters called opened a Café Printemps in Ginza to reproduce a cafe in Paris. But kisaten didn't really surge in popularity until after World War II because Japan had to resume imports of coffee. And like my parents, my dad used to go to kisaten, and that's to me very nostalgic. But it sounds like the popularity of kisaten is really strongly coming back.
I think it is. What I've heard are many, many kisatens are closing because the original proprietors are retiring. But so there is a declining number of kisatens, but I do think that's strengthening. There is a resurgence of interest in kisaten by younger generations and people who are interested in coffee. So I think the number of kisatens will eventually kind of stabilize, and you'll see the best ones thriving.
Right. Okay. And they tend to be mom and pop.
Yes.
So like master is the husband, the wife bakes the sweets.
Yeah, yeah. Daibo coffee was very much like that.
Okay, right. And so I saw one of your past interview articles, and you said Japanese kisaten is devoted to quality and has its own style to achieve the highest quality. So could you elaborate on that?
Yes. One of the things I love about kisaten is the very personal nature of each one. They can be radically different styles of coffee preparation, coffee roasting, of hospitality, of the space. In the United States, sometimes, and in Europe, especially Scandinavia, there's a kind of a rigor. There's an accepted way that coffee is made, and if you don't make it this certain way, then somehow you have less credibility. Freud has a term for that, I think. He calls it the narcissism of small differences. But in Japan, I feel like there's a wider tolerance for disparate styles as long as they're defended very rigorously. And that's the thing that I love, are participating in all these different styles of Japanese coffee.
Right. That's interesting. So, like, it sounds like, you know, kendo, judo, sado in Japan is the way. Do is the way. So that kind of... you know, your own concentration to the spirit.
Yeah.
And as far as you are all working towards the same spiritual concentration, it's okay, whoever it's doing.
Exactly. The important thing is the work.
Right. And so, I mean, to me, the kisaten baristas reminds me of tea master, of traditional tea ceremony. And I found an article about Japanese coffee culture in the National Geographic magazine. And there is a quote from one of the kisaten owners. And he says, Japanese people believe... that there is no highest form of any practice. Instead, we follow the way of Do. For example, Sado, the ceremony, is the way of tea. Judo is a way of self-defense. Kendo is a way of the sword. And one always exercises the discipline, but one never becomes the best at it. So this is how I view coffee, and there can be many ways to brew it, like you said, but there's no best way, only improvements.
I like that. That really resonates with me. That's my experience, and I value that sense of modesty. We were talking earlier about this six-seat bar, cocktail bar in Shimbashi that I love so much, and the gentleman proprietor of Land Bar Artisan, he really has dedicated the last 20 years of his professional career to the gimlet, and the gimlet is very simple. He uses beefeater gin and limes and simple syrup, but there's something extraordinary about how he approaches just the delicacy and the balance of that cocktail to be in his space and to get a gimlet that he has made with utmost concentration is a real privilege. But he also has this sense. He talks about his teacher and how great his teacher's gimlets were. You know, there's this sense that Daisuke doesn't feel like, oh, I'm the gimlet champion. You know, it's like he's never going to wake up and feel like he's got the gimlet figured out.
Mm.
And I love being around people like that.
Right.
Certainty, to me, is a very unattractive quality.
Mm. I think the master's mindset of any dough, the way, I think once it becomes the kind of like arrogant,
you fail
the moment you become arrogant,
you're
a failure. So that's tough.
It's tough.
So the Japanese barista's technical precision is pretty famous. So could you give us some examples?
Yeah, just with anything, you know, the pouring the water is something that you really have to think long and hard about and practice. I like to see at one of the kisotens I like to go to, they have delicious chiffon cakes. And just to watch the baristas frost the cakes, they have a bowl and they whip cream and they whip the cream perfectly. And then the chiffon cake has a center. Imagine a bundt pan. It's sort of like that. It has a center hole in it. And I remember being there with my wife one time and watching one of the baristas frost the cake. He frosted it beautifully. And then we were wondering, like, this moment of tension. Is he going to frost the inside of the hole where nobody can see? Yes, he frosted the inside of the hole. So this deep caring about little details, which are not, in fact, trivial, they all accrete, they all accumulate to make a whole. It's like a Georges Seurat painting, you know, all these little perfect dots. When you stand back, then they become something that you can't see until you have a little perspective. How beautiful all these dots are in as individuals, but then what the picture that they collaborate to make.
Right. Okay, and I found another quote of your past interview, and you said, in a traditional Japanese siphon bars, the barista brew each cup by hand, and they use bamboo paddles to stir the cup, creating whirlpools in no more than 4 turns and never touching the glass, and the coffee masters serve paddles, carves paddles to fit their palms. So that's, I think, it's unthinkable. And the chiffon cake inside, I mean, it's amazing that you pay attention to if the inside is proposed or not.
That's, right. It matters. Somehow it matters.
So I think you speak the same language.
I do feel like a sense of belonging there that I've rarely feel anywhere else. Even though I speak a few words of Japanese, I don't speak the language, and I often get lost, but it feels like home sometimes more than San Francisco does.
Okay. So what is a typical style of coffee served at Japanese kisaten?
I don't know if you can say there's a typical style. One of my favorite styles they call, or it translates to Nel Drip, and that's a little flannel, a cloth flannel sack, sometimes often with a wire frame, and there can be a tremendous amount of coffee. The brewing ratio is maybe four parts water to one part coffee. So tremendously small brewing ratio, fairly coarse grind, very slow extraction. And I love that style particularly just because it there's a voluptuousness to it. It's almost like, I don't know, drinking warm frosting or molasses. There's the way they can coax flavors out of that long, long extraction and what the flannel does to the texture.
Right.
That is, it's very, first of all, it's very hard to find that taste in the United States. So I try to avail myself of it when I have the opportunity. But I think I like that. And it's also, there's a transgressive nature to it because in the United States, it's like, if you're not brewing at 17 to 1, you're going straight to coffee hell. Mm. You know, I don't really like that kind of set of expectations. So the transgressive nature of the small brewing ratio, the low brewing temperature, the long extraction, it's wrong to a lot of coffee experts' eyes. But if that's wrong, I don't want to be right. Right.
Right. So probably it's kind of more delicate and softer.
I wouldn't call that style delicate at all. It's very, very thick, very, very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to siphon bars, that's when there's real delicacy.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other styles. This place that I talk about, Cafe Baja, they have a way of brewing paper filter.
Mm.
That's oftentimes a wider brewing ratio, and it can be quite delicate, quite kaleidoscopic.
Okay, so because it's so slow and then thicker,
the whole
essence came out. So that's like dense.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about how James applies the elements of Japanese coffee culture to Blue Bottle Coffee. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
So welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from our studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is James Freeman, who is the founder of Blue Bottle Coffee and one of the top coffee roasters in the U.S. So other thing about Japanese coffee, it's siphon. Siphon used to be very popular in Japanese kisaten, and some of them still use siphon to make coffee, including now you do too at Blue Bottle. So what is so special about siphon?
Well, you get a lot when you order siphon. It's a very theatrical way of making coffee, so it's beautiful to watch.
Mm.
It's very crystalline, almost the opposite kind of taste as the nail drip. So it's very crystalline. At its best, for me, what siphon coffee is a real voyage. It's when it's hot, when it comes out piping hot, actually it doesn't taste that interesting.
Mm.
But as it cools, it really draws you in, and every sip as it cools can be a different kind of taste.
Hmm.
So from the top of the cup to the bottom, you really get a kaleidoscopic view of this coffee that you're drinking. And that's one of the things I love about siphon. It's the journey from hot to cool.
Interesting. So I tried a siphon a couple times in my life, and I should drink slower. Yeah, it was really great too. And by waiting, looking at how it's made.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And another interesting thing is aged coffee beans, which is very popular in Japan. And I heard that some places offer 10, 20 year old beans. And I heard one place, 20-year-old beans, a cup for $1,000 and spoonful for $20.
$1,000? Wow.
So have you ever tried aged bean coffee?
Oh, sure. One of my favorite places is Café Lambre in Ginza. Mm. That's been open since 1948, and they have, I've had decades-old coffee. I've paid, I mean, I don't like to focus on the price, and I never really look, because when I want a coffee, I just want a coffee. I doubt that I've paid $1,000 for coffee, maybe $18 mm-hmm. for a demi-tasse of something delicious. I think I got a coffee from Mexico from 1976.
Wow.
That was very delicious. Very much not like a kind of coffee you would get in a specialty coffee bar in the United States. That's another, that kind of aged coffee is another thrill because it is quite transgressive. You're supposed to, and we work very hard. I don't want to diminish that. We work very hard to get fresh crop coffee in, to get it roasted well, and to get it out to have fresh crop coffee. And that can be very delicious and very vital. Mm. But I also think it's very interesting to see what other people are doing with aged coffee. Mm. And what they're doing at Café Lambre, I think, is very distinct, very delicious. Mm. And it's a beautiful environment, too. I just had, it's funny, the roastery is a few blocks away, our new roastery in Bushwick, and I just had two coffees, a Silvia Barreto coffee from FAF in Brazil, roasted a month ago, and then that same crop from 1 year ago that our very geeky barista had saved, and she made Nel Drip for me, and she wanted to have that taste, that comparison between this is post-roast, which is really interesting, and what she coaxed out of the one-year roasted coffee with this special way of pouring and doing it in the Nel was like so like candied orange peel. It was very delicious taste. Mm. And that shouldn't be good. One-year-old post-roast coffee should not be good.
Right.
But I think that's part of the culinary genius of the Kisaten is taking sometimes fairly modest ingredients, but transforming them through process, through technique, through execution into something that's quite magical. If you've ever had amazing polenta, you don't think, oh, well, this is just cornmeal and water, right? You know, there's something magic has happened. Similarly with these kinds of tricky things that they can do with technique. Yeah.
Right. So when you say aged coffee, it's before being roasted, like you said.
Yeah, there's really two ways of thinking about it. Usually in Japan, aged coffee means aged green coffee, unroasted coffee. But and then they roast it, can roast it quite dark. What we've been experimenting with similar extraction parameters is post-roast.
Mm.
And that has a different set of kinds of tastes that are quite
because
delicious.
I think if you pre-roasting, they are still more alive, you know, flavor alive.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
keeps changing.
Yeah.
And I heard it gets milder, less acidic.
Yeah, I think it depends on the coffee and the age and the extraction, but I think in general that's safe to say.
Mm. And then post-roast, the roasting part gets more accentuated?
No, actually just certain parts of the flavor. In this case, this one-year-old coffee, post-roast, just a certain, like you got this one glimpse at this coffee and all the other parts of it, all the other aspects have somehow faded away and you got one perspective and it was a really interesting perspective.
Mm.
So that was quite striking to me.
Mm. Okay. And so I have so many questions for you. So let's change the subject. So
okay.
What do you think about the food items that are offered at the Kisaten? Because that's a big part of the culture.
Oh, yeah. I love the just in general, the coffee and cake culture that it's, you know, in the afternoon, a lot of people will go get coffee and cake, whether it's a bakery or a Kisaten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love that many, like there's nothing on that menu of a good Kisaten that isn't deeply, deeply regarded.
Mm.
That isn't considered from the beginning of it to the end. One of the most expensive things on the menu that of a Kisaten that I like to go to is the grape juice.
Mm.
Like 900 yen for grape juice.
Wow.
And it's really delicious. It's from, I don't know, Kyushu or something like that. But that, you know, they, somebody has clearly put a lot of thought into what kind of grape juice they should serve, and they don't care that it's really expensive. It's the best one, and they're going to serve that one.
Right.
So similarly with cakes and cookies, not all of them are to my taste at every kisetan I go to, but they're always similarly deeply regarded.
Right. And typically, you know, like this called the morning service and breakfast.
Oh, toast, and,
yeah. Yeah, the thick toast. And the Japanese bread can be crazy high quality. And most of them, they're really obsessed about everything, including bread. So like thick toast and then there's butter.
Thick toast that's, and the bread's already buttered. That bread is so fluffy. It's this far away from cake. Anyway, you know, if it's the afternoon, you might as well eat cake. But I really love that toast service.
Right. And this is a funny thing. So in some places, especially in Nagoya, when you order coffee in the morning service is served, which is basically free. And you can typically get thick butter toast with like eggs and sandwiches, and or it can be
That's
Japanese.
Nice.
Yeah, I heard it's for free. How do you make money out of it? I don't know.
Oh, I don't know.
But a cup of coffee and people, I mean, my friend from Nagoya said, you have to have morning coffee because it's the best bargain. So anyway, so how do you apply the element of Japanese coffee culture to your coffee at the brew bottle?
We're not trying to make a kisetan, but I have been inspired by the tools and techniques that are part of Japanese coffee history. So the kettles, how we measure everything, the pour over that we do, that's very much a part of my inspiration.
Right.
We have these slow drippers made by Oji Company. They're beautiful sculptural round glass things that drip coffee very, very slowly over a period of 8 to 12 hours.
Mm.
So that's very directly not the taste that we're making, but that equipment, you know, technique informs flavor. And so even though we're not trying to capture the same flavor of the kisetan, the fact that we're being inspired by the tools and techniques puts our flavor in a certain place, I think.
Right. Okay. And now you have 6 shops in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Aoyama, Kiyosumi, Roppongi, Shinjuku, Shinaga, Nakameguro, all those great places.
Yes, very good. Yes.
And so that was the first location outside the U.S. So did you adjust the menu for the location in Japan?
No. That was one of the reasons we opened in Tokyo without a license, without a joint venture that was 100% funded by Blue Bottle Coffee US, was because over the years I'd been having meetings and we would always get to a point. We'd get close and then we'd get to a point where somebody would say, well, you know, Japanese people like darker coffee. Japanese people want smaller cookies. Japanese people want this or that. Mm. And that just kind of bummed me out being at that point because I didn't want anybody telling me what Japanese coffee wanted when it was my thesis that what Japanese coffee customers wanted was what we did in Oakland, what we did in San Francisco.
Mm.
And I wanted to give them that. I wanted to give them the best expression of Blue Bottle Coffee, the most honest expression of Blue Bottle Coffee that we could create.
Right.
And so that's what we did. And I'm just trying to do better than we do in Oakland.
Mm.
In Tokyo, and people have really responded to
that. I think that's what people are looking for, not the one of those another similar.
Yeah.
Right. And obviously, I think you're inspiring people. And I think American-trained baristas are opening cafes in Japan, too.
Yeah. It's nice to see. The coffee culture, even though we've only been opened for 2 years now in Tokyo, I feel like the coffee culture, the sort of more third-wave style, if you can allow that phrase, has really expanded. A lot of Japanese baristas with Australian or U.S. training or U.S.-based companies are opening.
Mm. Okay. And I think people, our listeners, want to know what your favorite kisaten is or are. How many places? I don't know. You can name.
Mm. Well, I loved Daibo Coffee when it was open. He closed a couple of years ago.
Mm.
One of the great thrills of my life was being invited to Mr. Daibo's house to have him make coffee.
Wow.
That was great. So that was inspiring. Hatto in Shibuya is very inspiring.
Sate Hatto in Shibuya.
Yes. Delicious cake, beautiful coffee, pristine.
Is that the chiffon cake place?
Yes, I have to go there. Yes. And there's another place I love called Cafe Baja. That's way out east. It's Manami Senju.
Mm-hmm. In Taitoku, the downtown Tokyo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. Closed on Friday, don't forget. And that's a great place because it's got a great history. It's in a very unlikely neighborhood. It's not a posh neighborhood. Mm. And his wife is a French-trained pastry chef. And so the coffees are delicious, beautifully executed, but also the pastries are very good. If you get there earlier in the day, there's more variety.
Mm.
Café Lambre in Ginza. Those are the places that I go to the most.
Okay.
I need to do a little more exploring, but right, those tend to be my favorites.
So I'm going
to
put those names on the show page.
Yeah,
so.
Please do.
Right. And you're going to explode those places.
Oh, right? Good.
Yeah, so, well, actually, I checked and I have not been there, but I saw the website of Café Baja. Mm-hmm. And it opened in 1968.
Yes.
And owned and run by a couple for the last 40 years or so.
Yeah.
And they hand pick coffee beans carefully and roast them daily with a customized roaster at the shop. And the wife bakes the bread and sweets that go well with the coffee. And, yeah, the menu shows about 20 kinds of beans from all over the world. And also indicates which beans are light, medium, semi-dark, dark roasted. So
yeah.
It's a really amazing place.
There's a beautiful variety of tastes on that menu.
Mm. And typical mom and pop establishment.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So, okay. And what's your plan for the future?
I don't really think about plans too much. We've got a lot of shops in the pipeline, so we're probably going to open one or two shops in Tokyo and a handful of shops in New York this year. LA, we just opened a couple. And then we have new markets. We're opening in Washington, D.C., Boston, Miami this year.
Mm.
So it will be a busy year.
Right. But interesting that, you know, all the locations are in the States. So why did you open a place in Japan outside?
I wanted a reason to go to Japan. I also felt that there was a significant business opportunity because we had this cultural resonance with old school Kiseten coffee culture. It was a way of kind of reflecting to a different type of guest, maybe a younger guest who, as you said, is like, oh, my dad used to go to Kiseten, who had that idea of Kiseten in the back of their mind, but this is a different way of presenting certain ways of feeling about coffee that maybe are not dissimilar to the Kiseten.
Mm, right. Yeah. Well, the other thing about the Kiseten, that's reminded me, it's like, you know, the teacups. Mm. Could be antique.
Yes, yes, yes.
And you know what kind of ambience he wanted to produce, the master wanted to produce. It's just everything.
Right, yes. I was at Hatto with a colleague, a Blue Bottle colleague, who speaks Japanese. He's Japanese and speaks great English. And for years, I'd been haunted with this idea. They have a million mismatched cups there, and I would see the baristas often. They would move a cup over on a high shelf and reach for a different cup, the same volume behind it. And I couldn't figure out, like, what is behind it? Like, why did they choose this cup and not that cup?
Mm.
You know, why did I get this cup and not the other cup? And I finally had the courage to ask my colleague, to ask the master, so what's going on here? Tell me about the cups. And it was so beautiful and actually so daunting. What he said, apparently, was that maybe 75% of their guests are regulars.
Mm.
So when he chooses a cup, he wants to give the regular a different experience than the last time they were there. And then also, when I was there at that time, it was October, so grapes were in season, and this particular cup I got had grapes, and then he went on to say that, you know, he liked to express the seasons in the cups. But that simple thing he said, he wants the regulars to have the experience of drinking out of a different cup, the meaning was so profound, because what does that mean? That means he remembers what cup the person had their coffee in last time.
Right.
And the time before that.
Mm.
And so because he remembers, it's like, oh, I'm not going to give him this cup. I'm going to give him that cup.
Wow.
So that's the hidden type of virtuosity that I'm talking about.
Mm.
And just knowing that, as soon as you get to what you think is the top of the mountain, all you see are
So it's
more mountains to climb, right?
Omotenashi hospitality.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
In a very deep, and profound, unique way.
So it's not just the precision or the quality of the beans and concentration, it's the hospitality element in Kesa Den.
Yeah. Sometimes people think hospitality is like being nice or chatting or something, but the depth of how they think about hospitality expressed in that way, oh, I care about you so much, I'm going to remember what cup you drank out of last time.
Mm.
That's a deep thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's Kesa Den.
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you for sharing all those amazing ideas.
My pleasure.
So please come back.
I will.
Yep. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So listeners, if you'd like to know more about James' excellent coffee, please visit bluebottlecoffee.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at JapanEats@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays, always available at HeritageRadioNetwork.org, iTunes and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And today's show was made possible by Corinne, and our engineer is David Tatasiore. And thank you for listening. I will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.